This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Some schools have already opened their doors to students, and with more opening in the coming weeks. But with the pandemic ongoing and an increase in new variant cases, what are schools doing to prepare? To talk more about this, we have with us now Jeannie Lindsay, education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Jeannie. When is school starting for students in Indiana?
Well, some people might already be seeing buses around town because for some this week, some today, others are starting next week or the following week. So back to school is upon us.
Mm-hmm. That sounds so early to me. I don't know. I always imagine school starting in the fall.
Right. Indiana does start pretty early compared to some other states, for sure. I know that when I came here and people were talking about back to school, I was also surprised. It was end of July, start of August.
Yeah, but they get out earlier, right?
Right. Yes, they do.
Okay. So it balances out.
Right.
Well, what do you know about the plans for Indiana schools this year when it comes to how they're planning to operate? Is there going to be this hybrid? Is it going to be virtual? Is it all dependent?
Yeah, so unfortunately, there is no database available for me to peruse to identify how everybody's doing it. But from what I have seen, there are not nearly as many virtual or like hybrid options. Some schools that were offering virtual options are still maintaining those. Some got rid of their virtual options. But virtual schools and virtual education was already kind of on the rise in Indiana. Some schools were already creating dedicated virtual schools. But some of the things we saw last year as people were bringing kids back during the pandemic, kind of responding first full pandemic school year, we saw a lot of hybrid schedules where kids were coming in for some days, not, you know, coming in for other days. And so I haven't seen any hybrid schedules like that at this point. I think people are, you know, offering virtual options if someone wants to, you know, do only virtual or only in person. But we're not seeing nearly as many, if any, of sort of the hybrid models and you know, the mixing of instruction there.
Are schools still weighing the options when they're looking at these variants coming out? Or is it pretty much set in stone that they're going to pull through no matter what?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a lot of interest in bringing kids back in person and keeping kids back in person. So obviously, the situation now is a lot different. We don't have as many state restrictions. You know, the numbers look a lot different. And, you know, while the Delta variant is, you know, on the rise right now, schools have been working all summer to figure out sort of what their communities want and what's going to be best to keep kids in school in person as much as possible if you know, that's what people are asking for. And so I think the tone of this moment is also very different. You know, schools obviously are still talking about health and safety protocols, especially as that, you know, continues to change and be fluid. There was an update, you know, just yesterday from the CDC. So I think that they're still trying to have some of that adaptability and flexibility with those plans as they, you know, re-enter the school year. But they certainly are focused more, I think, now on the recovery component of getting kids back in person, getting them the academic opportunities that many of them may have missed out on, but also sort of the social and emotional supports that kids didn't have. So there certainly is, you know, still a mind to keep eyes on the pandemic, but it's not as, I think, front and center for a lot of people, especially after a year of dealing with it. People are tired. So there's less of I think an intensity on the focus of how to respond to the pandemic. People are tired, but also, you know, maybe more practiced with it. But there certainly is a lot, you know, there's been pushback for different, you know, things and that sort of, you know, masking and the sort of parameters that have been set. So schools are really interested in keeping kids, you know, in person as much as they can and really hitting that academic recovery moment because it is so critical for so many.
Right, right. And, you know, when you're saying that people are tired, I'm thinking I think maybe also there was so much fear in the beginning. And now folks are like, you know, I'm going to take a risk. Whereas before, maybe people were not willing to take
risks. Right, right. There's a little bit more familiarity, too. You know, it's not just a brand new COVID-19 thing. Like we've been living with it we've been in a pandemic world for more than a year now. So, so yeah, absolutely.
Well, what have you heard about families when it comes to sending their kids back to school? Because I'll say full disclosure for me, I don't know that I feel comfortable sending my kids back to school.
Yeah, so the back to school in person certainly has been something that parents I've talked to are really eager to do. I mean, obviously, keeping in mind the health and safety components, you know, they want to do what's best to protect not only their kids, but, you know, their families as well. I mean, the numbers for kids look a lot better than, you know, some of the adults, some of the older adults, but kids can still carry stuff home. So right. Parents are really, you know, trying to find the balance of what's best for their children and also for their families at large. But the parents I've talked to are really eager to get these opportunities back to let their kids kind of just be kids again, right? Like, it has been such a hard year. And when you go to school, obviously the academic components are, you know, obviously very important. It's a school, but with in-person school, there are so many other things. I mean, there are field trips, there's extracurriculars, you know, the swim meet, the band concert, you know, and parents are really missing that for their kids because you only get to go to school once. I mean, right. once you grow up, you're, you know, out in the world. So parents are really eager to have those opportunities for academics, but also, you know, hanging out with their friends, their kids, having those connections with their peers. The other thing I'll say too, I mean, for working parents, it's also an opportunity to have a little bit more freedom to you know, do the work that they need to do to pay the bills and you know, keep food on the table. So I think there's a lot of interest in person for a multitude of reasons. And right now, you know, parents are either sending their kids back to school or trying to find, you know, what option will work for them to strike that balance of opportunity and, you know, a childhood, but also health and safety in this very serious pandemic moment.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine that also getting back to school in person is helpful, especially for families that may rely on food services and other services that are provided by the school that they're not able to get without being in school. Yeah. Now, I know the results for iLearn were released recently. We're going to talk more about it in the next segment. But can you just break it down for our audience? What is iLearn?
Yeah, so iLearn is the state's standardized assessment. And every state has a standardized assessment. It's a requirement from federal law. So iLearn is Indiana's newest iteration of that. The previous one was the iStep Plus. Some folks might remember that. But the first time the iLearn was administered was actually in 2019. So it's fairly new. And this year is only the second time it's been administered because of, you know, the pandemic disrupting things last year. So it is just a standardized assessment that all kids across the state take. And there are different subject areas for different grades. So third through eighth graders, you know, they will take English, language arts, and math. You know, some other elementary grades will take social studies or science. And then there is a high school biology iLearn and a government iLearn for some of those higher grades. So that is a quick breakdown of what the iLearn is.
And what stands out about the results so far?
Well, I think one of the things that's striking, I mean, covering standardized assessments, you know, you get used to seeing some of the gaps between student groups. There have been persisting gaps among different, you know, demographics of students, you know, for all the time that I've been an education reporter, which isn't too terribly long. But so the gaps are still there among different student groups. I think one of the things that stands out to me is just how low some of the proficiency rates are. People, you know, call these gaps achievement gaps. I call them opportunity gaps most of the time. And it essentially highlights, you know, different students who are, you know, being given different resources or maybe not enough resources to reach proficiency on this exam. And so I think one of the things that is still striking to me every time I look at these is, you know, those gaps and how big those are. But this year, for sure, how low some of those proficiency rates are for different student groups because of, you know, the effects of the pandemic, but also persisting inequities in education that you know, have yet to be addressed. Mm-hmm. So some of the groups that stood out, I mean, Black and Hispanic students, low income students, English learners. The data shows that those groups are reaching proficiency in English and math between 6% and 15%. So proficiency in both of those is, you know, for some in single digits, which is a very small number and shows that, you know, it's a clear indicator that there's a problem that needs to be addressed in schools.
Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll talk a little more about that after the break of how this stuff can be addressed. You know, are these standardized tests just taken, or is there anything done after the results come in. We'll continue our conversation on iLearn with education reporter Jeannie Lindsay, and we'll have another guest join her after a quick break. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. I'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Before the break, we got an update on education stories in Indiana and touched a little bit on iLearn with our education reporter, Jeannie Lindsay. Now we're also joined by Damian Bedebenner, a senior associate at the National Center for the Improvement of Educational Assessment, to talk about an ongoing study focused on the academic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. If you have any questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. We also have another way you can get to us. You can send us a voice message through our free smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. Well, welcome back, Jeannie, and welcome, Damian. Thank you both for joining us as we discuss more about the academic impact of the pandemic. Jeannie, before the break, we talked about the iLearn test results, which were lower this year. What was the reaction to that news?
Yeah, so the iLearn results were not particularly surprising. People were kind of expecting that to drop off a bit. And, you know, state officials made that really clear once the iLearn had been taken and results were available. So while there was response, about how low they were, a lot of leaders were really quick to point out that these results were nobody's fault, really. They didn't want these to be used to, you know, shame teachers for anything, because teachers have been working their tails off during the pandemic in so many different ways. So leaders were pretty quick to say that. And just point out that, you know, nobody asked for a pandemic. And so not to use these scores against anyone for, you know, the impact of something pretty much out of a lot of people's control.
Right. And are parents on board with saying that this was just due to the pandemic, or are they thinking that enough wasn't done in this school system?
Yeah, so, you know, parents, I think, that I've talked to have pretty much kind of accepted what standardized testing does or does not mean to them. You know, one parent that I talked with the president of the Indiana Parent Teachers Association, and she, you know, doesn't like the iLearn at all. She has problems with the test itself, says, you know, it shouldn't be used. She said something to me along the lines of it's designed for kids to fail it. So she's not a fan of this test. And I think that, you know, the results are, you know, the way that she perceives the results are going to be informed by that, you know, by her opinion, her experience with her own kids. Another parent I talked to is really less worried about how her kids performed on this test and more focused on how schools respond to the moment that we're in. You know, she was focused on, when she was talking to me, you know, she just wants schools to provide equal opportunities for kids, and isn't as concerned about, you know, the test scores and the data, more about what's actually happening in schools and how they're responding to the individual needs of the students they serve.
Mm-hmm. Well, Damian, we mentioned the Department of Education has a study on the academic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. How did this study start?
This study began with legislation that Indiana legislature passed, I believe in January, that mandated that the Department of Education actually investigate the academic impacts of the pandemic on students. And so the Department of Ed, given that task, reached out to our organization and asked if we would be willing to oversee the writing of that report. And so we've been actively working with them since February, really, to try to both collect data, get things stood up so that we can figure this out as quickly as possible, get the results back to the department so that they are as actionable as can be.
And the study that's being done, is this, are you responsible just for Indiana, or is this nationwide?
This study is just for Indiana, though our organization's working with about a dozen states to investigate academic impacts. Mm-hmm. Indiana's is probably the most extensive because the legislation sort of forced the hand of the Department of Ed to dig into this.
And so what kind of data is being used, or how are you measuring the impact?
So there's really three types of data that we're looking at. As Jeannie mentioned, there's the iLearn, which I guess I would say is probably the best source of data that we have. There's also an English language proficiency exam that's given to English language learners called the Access Test that is given in K through 12 that can be used to assess the impact on English language learners. And then Indiana also has data sharing agreements with several interim assessment vendors. And so we've been able to look at some of the interim assessment data that came from fall and winter of 2020, and we'll hopefully be getting additional data to look at that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm presuming that you're going to be comparing the data to the year before, or is there any sort of standard that you're looking at?
That's exactly right. So in order to understand sort of what the impact of the pandemic is, we need to sort of know what life was like before the pandemic, pre-COVID. So our organization's been working with Indiana for about a decade. So we understand ISTEP, ISTEP Plus, iLearn, and all of these exams, and sort of set up, in a sense, a counterfactual of what was going on before the pandemic, so we can understand what's going on during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask Jeannie a little bit more about the standardized testing, I do want to ask you, Damien, you mentioned you also look at this iLearn test results. I mean, is it going to be that accurate? Did a lot of people end up taking it this year?
Yes, actually, Indiana gets a gold star for participation rates this year compared to most states in the country, where it had, I believe, close to 97% of students taking the test. The standard threshold that states try to hit is 95%. So they were above sort of this threshold that the federal government often holds them to. So a lot of kids took the test, which makes it so that we don't have to deal with issues, big issues such as missing data that exist in other states.
Right.
And gives us sort of a cleaner view of what's actually going on.
That's interesting. Yeah, I was wondering, you know, if you didn't get enough data from the pandemic, then how would you be able to measure it? But it sounds like you've got more than what you probably expected.
For sure. Yeah, it makes our job easier. The other states that we're working with, things are a little bit more sparse. But one thing that allows Indiana to lead in this is that given the findings that one sees in Indiana, if other states with lesser data see similar findings, it lends credence to the fact that those findings would hold even if there had been higher participation rates in those other states.
Well, Jeannie, when it comes to standardized testing, it sounds like Indiana hasn't been that affected by the pandemic. People are still taking them, or is that not the case?
Well, this past spring, you know, was kind of the return to standardized tests. So in 2020, you know, that spring, schools went remote right after, you know, I think second week of March, and a lot of them never came back. And so the state canceled standardized testing. Everybody kind of got a pass to not take the standardized test. And so Indiana is kind of in an interesting position, though, because I think I mentioned earlier that iLearn was rolled out for the first time in 2019 as it was replacing the ISTEP. And so students had only taken the iLearn one time, and then it was canceled in 2020. And then coming back this spring, there were still kids that were, you know, learning remotely. Not everybody was in person. And the U.S. Department of Education, you know, basically said to states, hey, if you need flexibility, we're willing to work with you on that. You know, if it's extending the testing timelines, shortening the length of the test, or having kids take it not in person. Indiana, you know, stuck to sort of business as usual as much as it could. And obviously with 97% participation, did pretty well getting kids in to take the full version of the test. But yeah, it's definitely interesting. Kids are taking, took iLearn for the second time ever, right after it was canceled because of the pandemic.
Mm. And for folks that, you know, were able to skip it last year because there was no test being given, did that make anyone think that they just don't want to do these tests anymore?
Well, For as long as standardized testing has been done, there's been a debate about whether it should or shouldn't be. You know, depending on who you ask, there are people who saw, you know, standardized testing being canceled in 2020 as an opportunity to change the way things looked and to change how standardized testing is used and perceived and offered. So some people did see it as an opportunity and sort of celebrated the fact that kids didn't have to take this. But, you know, as Damian mentioned, I mean, there's a lot of data that iLearn provides, and it is also a federal requirement. So unless the, you know, U.S. Department of Education says no more standardized testing, it's not going to go away. So it is interesting, though, with all the conversations in schools about flexibility and changing things and, you know, reworking processes as an opportunity in this pandemic. It'll be interesting to see kind of how that changes with standardized testing moving forward, if at all. But yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag depending on who you're talking to.
Mm-hmm. Well, Damian, with the study that you're conducting and this research that you're doing, what will the results be used for? Like, what will that help you do?
Primarily, the results are going to be used to inform how Indiana moves forward. Following what the Secretary of Ed said at the state board meeting, the goal isn't to use this as a retrospective view and go and start pointing fingers at what happened previously, but to try to see, in a sense, how big of a hole students are in and how long and how much support it will take to actually sort of climb out of these academic holes. So I often try to say that hopefully this is used to right-size the interventions. And as we communicated at the state board meeting, these interventions, given the size of the impact, are likely to be multi-year interventions where people are going to have to expect this to be something that just isn't going to happen in a few months. We're going to have to follow students, track them along, and pay attention to where they're at so that they can catch up to where they would have been had the pandemic not occurred.
Mm-hmm. Do you think any of the results that you have found, does that mean that these schools are going to have lower scores? Are they going to be reflected negatively if somebody were looking for a school to go to?
That's a good question. I would say, given people's sort of attitude towards looking at schools, they could be, given the way that some of the real estate websites use that data.
Mm-hmm.
Optimistically, one hopes that these data will be used to try to help people see what the overall size of the impact is. And as I said, look at it with a sober lens and really try to build the mechanisms that can help students out.
And Jeannie, when it comes to these results from test scores, are there any consequences that could result from this for parents, teachers, or students?
Yeah, fortunately, accountability has been waived. So the first year that iLearn was administered in 2019, lawmakers passed a hold harmless because there was a substantial drop in scores. And they kind of did the same thing this time. Coming out of the pandemic school year, they decided that accountability was these tests were not going to be used for accountability for teachers and schools. The federal Department of Education also provided waivers. So schools and teachers should not be worried about any sort of consequences. I think for parents, it's important to just, you know, recognize what these test scores do and do not say. I mean, these are not an entire encapsulation of a student's learning experience or abilities. It's, you know, a snapshot. It's a data point. So I don't think parents and students should be particularly concerned about how these test scores are going to be used, because officials have said, you know, from the start of the planning process, that this year's assessment data is really information only to get a better mm-hmm. grasp of what exactly is going on and what things look like.
Right. And when it comes to sort of this information, Damian, with the study that you have going, is it going to be released in enough time for folks to be able to figure out what students need and how to help them keep from falling behind?
I think so. As Jeannie mentioned, Indiana's got some schools that started up in early July. So they're already educating in those places. So the data isn't there for them. But again, if we think of this as something that is like a multi-year effort in most cases, that getting the data in August versus getting it in July or getting it in June, I think is not so material, that there's a long game in this, and that recognizing that this is where students are based upon the iLearn, this is where we would like them to be in 2022, in 2023, and 2024.
Well, when it comes to the pandemic's impact on academics, what did you see when it comes to Indiana compared to other states? I know Indiana had a great compliance when it came to taking the iLearn test, but in other elements, what was the comparison like?
We've looked at about a half a dozen states with summative assessment data thus far. And the patterns are generally the same. You see larger impacts than math than you do in English language arts. But that's not to say that the English language arts impacts are small. I would say Indiana's maybe slightly better than several of the other states that we're looking at, but I wouldn't call it like a lot better. There's still deep holes that actually need to sort of be recovered from. What I think is sort of critical here to recognize is that the impacts seem to be persistently large across all the grades that we were looking at. So this was from grades 3 through 8 in ELA and math. We were observing sort of large decreases. There wasn't, in a sense, groups that were, say, spared by the pandemic. Everybody seemed to just sort of get pushed down. And thus, when people go in and start looking at their data, coming in with preconceived notions of certain students not being impacted because they had iPads at home or things like that is probably not warranted.
And Jeannie, now that schools have these results, have you heard of them planning to do anything with the information?
You know, there's a lot of information to be had. I think that schools will obviously look at these results and you know, use the data in some form, but there's also so many other ways that classroom teachers are going to be assessing, you know, students and where they're at this point. So I think the task now for schools is to, you know, look at this data and see how what students have learned during the pandemic, because kids just didn't stop learning. It just was different. And how they can translate that to, you know, proficiency on assessments, but also, you know, just overall student success and support. So, you know, I think the next steps are, you know, really looking at what kids need and figuring out how to target the dollars that they have to address this constantly changing, evolving problem.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this afternoon. Jeannie Lindsay is an education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Damian Bedebener is a senior associate at the National Center for the Improvement of Educational Assessment. Thank you both so much for your time. After the break, we'll look at the future of space travel and space tourism with a local expert. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Space tourism has become a hot topic, with billionaires like Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos traveling past the stratosphere. But how accessible will space travel be, and is it good for the planet? To talk about it, we're joined by Barrett Caldwell, the director of the NASA Indiana Space Grant Consortium and professor of industrial engineering at Purdue University. Welcome to the program, Barrett. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get started, can we just define what is space tourism?
Wow. Several people have tried to come up with a specific definition. I would say space tourism is really the opportunity for someone to go above the various lines that we demarcate as the start of space for enjoyment or recreation rather than for science or engineering work or for exploration.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, as I asked you that, I started thinking about how we keep talking about these billionaires going up into space, but they didn't really go to space, did they? I mean, they didn't go to the moon.
No, but the idea of going to space is basically going through enough of the Earth's atmosphere to a certain altitude. If you look at the history of NASA, DOD, American efforts. That's been listed as an altitude of 50 miles. There is a scientific line called the Kármán line, which is based on how much atmosphere there is left. And that will vary between roughly 50 and maybe 65 or 70 miles. So they call it 100 kilometers or 62 miles because of the international standard.
Mm-hmm. And is that when you reach weightlessness? Is that when you know you're in space?
No, weightlessness is a really different idea. It's when you are falling as fast as the pull of gravity is exerting, so that even if you're in a vehicle that's orbiting the Earth, the idea of orbit is that you're falling towards the Earth, but by the time you move a certain distance, the vehicle has moved a certain distance as well, so you haven't changed your position. So weightlessness is really a matter of acceleration. It's not really a matter of altitude.
Interesting. Well, why do you think more private companies and billionaires are getting involved in this industry?
Well, I think that if they are anything like me, for instance, I grew up as a child of the Apollo spaceflights. I was riveted in front of television for Apollo 8 and for Apollo 11, and I said that's what I want to do with myself. I think there are a lot of people who've been inspired by space and have been inspired by the history of exploration. And I guess the difference when you have a 9 or 10 figure bank account is that you can actually make decisions to start supporting that spirit of exploration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's nice to be a billionaire. You can do whatever you want.
Well, I used to think so, and then I had my financial advisor explain to me all the other things that I would have to do. And when I managed my lab of about 5 or 6 students, and then I realized what I would have to do if I had to manage 50 or 60,000 people as the head of a company, suddenly it doesn't look so good to me anymore.
Right. Well, what role are local space experts playing in this field of space tourism, if any at all?
Well, there's a lot. There's, you know, a lot of discussion about how much this billionaire or that billionaire spent. But really, it's not like Elon or Jeff or Richard was hiding out in their basement by themselves, stealing aluminum off of somebody's loading dock. They're heads of companies. And in those companies, there are engineers, there are scientists, there are technicians who have been doing this work. And when those vehicles go and leave the Earth's surface, they're often carrying engineering experiments, scientific experiments that help us understand what is the capability for future spaceflight. Mm-hmm. So we have had Stephen Colicott, one of my colleagues here at Purdue, actually wasn't going to be able to join us this week because he's out doing research projects that look at what we call payload experiments, scientific research that can be done only or best in the realm of microgravity. One of the two crew members on the Virgin Galactic flight is a student, Sarisha Benlith, that I remember as an undergraduate. And she was as inspired by spaceflight as I was, hoping for the opportunity. Now she and Beth, another Purdue alumna, they've gone to space. They have their wings. And I think that those two, Wally Funk, are also going to be inspirations to other people in the future.
Mm-hmm. You know, I honestly didn't realize Purdue has such a big role with a lot of the space exploration stuff that goes on.
Yeah, we are very proud of having two things. One, lots of basketball championships, and the other one is having lots of astronauts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we now talk about NASA astronauts as well as commercial astronauts, we're at 26, I think, now. which is clearly the most among any public university. And that is one of the things that we're very proud of. Indiana as a whole has had a long history in the space program. Obviously, if you talk about Gus Grissom, an Indiana native, we have a number of other natives, Ken Bowersox and Charlie Walker, from that one county, Lawrence County in southern Indiana. But we also have companies that have been involved in the history of spaceflight, Alcoa, ITT. Those are names that you may not hear much anymore because they've changed their names. But they were there during the Apollo era. We've had payload research teams, Tech Shot now, started as a Purdue undergraduate science experiment. We've got high altitude and CubeSat launch capabilities that have been developed in the state of Indiana. Actually, we've got a company in Upland that Near Space Launch that's part of our space grant consortium. They are good at assembling and integrating CubeSats, and they've done so for Taylor University and for the University of Southern Indiana, that both have put CubeSats into orbit. And the University of Southern Indiana. And the University of Southern Indiana CubeSat is actually still in orbit as we speak.
Oh, that's fascinating. And you mentioned the Space Grant Consortium, the NASA Indiana Space Grant Consortium. What exactly is this program?
This is a program that is supported by the NASA Office of STEM Engagement. And there is a Space Grant Consortium in each of the 50 states, as well as the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico. They're standing up two more in Guam and the Virgin Islands. And the idea is to be a source of education and inspiration, but also a source of workforce development at the college level for students with an interest in engineering and science, for faculty that are developing new research programs, everything from agricultural monitoring to zoology. Are STEM fields that are supported by NASA because they are part of NASA's mission and NASA's emphasis on understanding the planet better and increasing the capability for engineering and scientific exploration.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to going back to sort of the space tourism stuff, are there any purists in the space industry that think that this is over the top?
I'm not really one to say that I've met many of those people. I think that, the people that I know are hardcore NASA people. They're thrilled for the opportunity to have more companies, more engineering designs, more opportunities to launch payloads, to get people to the space station, to help build the Artemis Gateway in cislunar space. The idea that this is only something to be done by a national government, I think that era is in many ways glad to be over, because it means that we're not just looking to a single organization or a single supply chain to do this work. I see people that are cheering just as hard for Blue Origin or SpaceX or Virgin Galactic as the latest NASA launch.
Mm-hmm. Well, how accessible is, and I keep saying space tourism, I don't know if there's a better word for it, but how accessible is it for folks to go up past the stratosphere right now?
Well, I think, if you look at the ticket prices, there's a challenge of, will there be enough seats for the people who want to go, is actually the bigger problem. I think it's about $250,000 for a seat. If I look at that, that's probably the cost of an RV. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a lot of people who would have the capability for it. Clearly, there are lots of people that have that much in their 401k. I won't say that's a majority of the population. Maybe it's 5 or 10% of the population. But we're not talking about the tens of millions maybe up to 100 million that people had paid for the opportunity to travel to the space station.
Mm. And that makes me wonder, though, the next step. I mean, there's this going up as far and as high as you can. Will there be a time when people can actually go and land on the moon, for example? I just think of the moon because, you know, as a child, those were the stories that we heard about the you know, that first step on the moon. Are we ever going to see that again?
That's a difficult question. You know, I think about the Stanley Kubrick movie, 2001, and the idea of the Hilton Hotel in space station and the lunar visits. Let's be clear. Getting to the moon is actually quite hard. And to say that we are going to have thousands of people doing that just for fun, I don't see that happening in the next 20 years. I don't see it, even if I had a longer lifespan than that, happening in my lifespan, because we've had only about a dozen people that have been able to see the Earth from the lunar surface. And the last time we did that was nearly 50 years ago. So to say we're going to go from 12 to 100 to 1,000 in the next 10 or 15 years, the engineering just doesn't support it. We don't have that level of capability. And the one other thing I have to say, these are experiments. These are test flights. This is not like going down to your favorite tropical island on an airplane with tens of millions of flight hours of prior experience.
That's a good point. And what are there when it comes to drawbacks, I guess, of doing space tourism, of even if it's, let's say, this $250K for a seat and there's enough people that'll be able to go back and forth. Is this good for the environment in the long run?
Is it good for the environment? There's lots of interesting questions there. If you look at particular types of launch fuels like kerosene, that's probably not the most environmentally friendly of fuels. But I would say that our Jet A fuel that we all have been used to using and are going back to as travel opens up again, Jet A fuel is not environmentally friendly. And the idea to go to low lead aircraft fuel is probably a much higher priority in terms of net impact on the planet. There are fuels, actually one that was developed by some researchers now at Purdue. It's a combination of aluminum and liquid ice, or liquid water turned into ice, called ALICE. For the aluminum ice mixture is probably a lot more environmentally friendly. And what you would see with some of these corporate experiments is more people testing more environmentally friendly fuels, more environmentally friendly construction or orbit management techniques. And that's what we always see, is that when there is one of those additional pressures, we see that through combinations of public-private or government-industry partnerships to say, let's see if that can work.
Right, right. Well, as we get ready to wrap up here in a couple of moments, is there anything interesting coming up in the space industry that you're looking forward to or excited to see?
Oh, there are so many things. In some ways, no, I'm not upset that I'm not 30 years younger, because I did get to see the Apollo missions. But there's a lot of excitement about the Artemis program, the idea of having a gateway, another station that's closer to lunar orbit. That's really, really exciting. As NASA says, putting the first woman and next man on the moon, chances are good that one of those people might be a Purdue astronaut. Just had to throw that in there. But we're talking about the gateway construction, cislunar supply chains, testing all those engineering capabilities, bringing the SLS online, having these corporate participants. These are things that are going to happen in the 2020s. And that's really, really exciting.
And do you think you mentioned that the next woman and man to go to the moon, do you think that's something we will see?
I think the designs are there. The commitment and the enthusiasm is there. I don't want to get into the politics of funding, but I think the ability to complete the engineering loops to get astronauts to the lunar surface again, no later than 26 or 27, possibly by 24 or 25. Yeah, I think it's eminently doable.
Awesome. Well, I'll definitely be looking forward to that. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Barrett Caldwell is the director of the NASA Indiana Space Grant Consortium and a professor of industrial engineering at Purdue University. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.